This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This episode is brought to you by Essentia. A better you starts with better hydration. Essentia is on a mission to inspire people to do what matters most. Their proprietary ionization process transforms water from any source into ionized alkaline water, providing water that's 99.9% pure with a pH of 9.5 or higher. Essentia overachieving H2O, the number one ionized alkaline water. Shop now.
At the UPS store, we know things can get busy this upcoming holiday. You can count on us to be open and ready to help with any packing and shipping or anything else you might need.
Is there anything you can't do?
Actually, I don't have a good singing voice. The UPS... Nope. But our certified packing experts can pack and ship just about anything.
At least that's good.
The UPS store. Be unstoppable. Most locations are independently owned. Product, services, pricing, and hours of operation may vary. See center for details. Come in today to get your holiday goodies there on time.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
And because quantum gravity, the problem of quantum gravity is so fundamental, space-time is, it is the arena in which everything that happens, happens. It is our universe. And so understanding that better at a fundamental level is bound to have consequences, which we can't foresee because we don't know what quantum gravity is yet. It's bound to have consequences in every part of our lives. Although, as I said, it's hard to predict what those will be.
You're listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling science and technology monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.
Hello, I'm Alexander McNamara, online editor at BBC Science Focus. This week, we're going on a search for the theory of everything. The two main theories of physics are at odds with each other. On one hand, you have Einstein's general relativity theory, which explains gravity, but it contradicts quantum theory, which explains how we understand matter, atoms, and particles. Theoretical physicist at the Imperial College London, Faye Dowker, has been working on a solution to this quantum gravity problem and tells our editorial assistant, Amy Barrett, why the theories are incompatible and how she plans to bring them together.
I am working on the problem of quantum gravity. And it's a problem and not a theory, because we don't have a theory of quantum gravity yet. So the problem is to, the challenge is to find one. And it's a problem because our current two best fundamental theories in physics are not compatible with each other. It's a strong statement to say that they are contradictory, but I'm not afraid of saying that, actually. I think science, it advances by looking at contradictions between our different pieces of our understanding, and it focuses on those contradictions in order to make progress. So science actually, it tolerates contradictions, but not forever. So at any particular moment in history, there will always be contradictions. Or there have always, let's say, in the past, been contradictions between different pieces of our understanding. And those contradictions are exactly where we want to focus on to, in order to do better, to try to unify our understanding.
So what are the contradictions involved in quantum gravity?
So our best theory of gravity currently is general relativity. And that was largely formulated by Albert Einstein. And according to this theory, gravitational phenomena, such as the motions of the planets around the sun, black holes, the motions of galaxies in the universe, are manifestations of the geometry of a fabric that we call space-time. Space-time is four-dimensional, and it's dynamical, so it has a life of its own. It is governed by laws of physics. It bends and it warps and it ripples, and it carries energy. It is a physical entity in our current understanding of gravity. And the way that it bends and warps and ripples is governed by the matter in the universe. So depending on what matter there is, then space-time responds to it. So if two black holes, for example, are in orbit around each other, in spiraling and towards each other, then that will create ripples in this space-time fabric that we call gravitational waves. But the contradiction arises because our very best and most fundamental understanding of matter is quantum mechanical. And one of the essential features of quantum mechanics is that quantum mechanical events are unpredictable. They're inherently unpredictable. When a quantum mechanical event happens, we don't know in advance what the outcome will be. We'll know what the possibilities are, but we won't know which one will happen. So it's like a horse race. You know that one of the horses will win, but you don't know which one in advance. And that is ignored. That feature of matter, that quantum mechanical feature of matter, is ignored by general relativity. General relativity assumes that matter behaves in a predictable, entirely predictable and deterministic way. So there's the contradiction. Quantum mechanics says that matter behaves in a stochastic or random way, but general relativity assumes that matter behaves in a predictable way.
So what are some examples of a quantum mechanical event? What could those be?
So, for example, at the moment, there is a huge amount of experimental work being done in the realm of optics and quantum optics in particular. And that's very exciting. A lot of my colleagues at Imperial College are experts in quantum optics. I really enjoy going down to see their experiments. And they're in quantum optics, one of the fundamental pieces of equipment that they use is are called interferometers. So, and in quantum optics, they can reduce the intensity of the light that they use in their experiments so that one particle of light called a photon is moving through the equipment, the interferometer, at a time. And when they use certain components of their equipment, this photon, when it passes through something called a half-silvered mirror, it can decide to do one of two things. It can either go straight through the half-silvered mirror, or it can reflect off it. And for a given photon, you cannot predict which way it's going to go. It will either go through it or reflect off it. And there's a 50-50 chance of it doing either of those two things. You can't predict in advance which one it's going to do. It will do one or the other, but you can't. And over time, the average will be that roughly half of the photons will go through and roughly half of the photons will reflect off. So that's something that it's inherently unpredictable which way the photon will go.
Right. And why doesn't that match up with general relativity?
So it's a feature of matter at large scales that this inherent unpredictability washes out. So what we see at macroscopic scales, the behavior of matter, is that this quantum uncertainty is hidden by the the statistical properties of the matter as a whole. I mean, these are very, this is a sort of rule of thumb, a sort of broad brushstroke description of how classical behavior or deterministic behavior, predictable behavior, arises from a quantum theory. Actually, the precise theoretical understanding of how that classical behavior arises from quantum mechanics is, in my opinion, absent. We can give this rule of thumb heuristic explanation, but it's actually there is no procedure within quantum theory to explain why this classical behavior arises or how it arises. In my opinion, that's one another problem that I work on in my research program, which is to try to understand how classical behavior arises from quantum behavior.
And how does your research, like how do you go about your research? What does a day look like for you?
I am a theoretical physicist, which means that I don't have a lab. I'm not tied to a lab. So I can do my research pretty much anywhere. I use a computer a lot. So I'm often sat at a desk reading papers on my computer. I find it hard to think without a piece of paper in front of me and a pen in my hand. So I'm doing calculations, scribbling notes down on paper. I'm often, so when I'm teaching, I am interspersing bouts of thinking about research and doing research with my preparation for teaching, meeting students. So yeah, typical day will involve perhaps a lecture, preparing for a tutorial, talking to my PhD students about their projects, sitting down, reading an interesting paper that's just come out. So it's very varied, and that's one of the great things about my work.
In terms of working on this problem of quantum gravity, is there any simulations involved, or is it really just hard maths?
It's both. My colleagues use a lot of computer simulations. Computers are incredibly useful, even though we're doing theoretical physics. People use computers to simulate the systems that they are, simulate the models that they are creating, also to solve hard equations. It's often computers can do what we can't do. So people use computers to solve, for example, differential equations. For example, the equations that govern the geometry and structure of space-time are Einstein's equations. They're very difficult to solve analytically, just with pencil and paper. And so people are using enormous amounts of computing power to solve those equations to tell us, for example, what the form of the gravitational waves coming from black hole collisions will look like. So, yeah, computers are a big part of theoretical physics today.
Right. And so there are lots of other physicists working on this problem currently.
There are. It's a community, a global community of people working on quantum gravity. There are different approaches. It's a strange situation at the moment, historically, in which the experimental evidence pointing us in one direction or another in quantum gravity research is very, very scarce, because the two realms in which both gravitational phenomena and quantum phenomena are rather extreme in themselves. And when you put them together, the sorts of realms in which they become really relevant are very extreme. So, for example, at the time of the Big Bang, which is roughly 13.7 billion years ago, when the matter in the universe was in a very hot, dense state, that realm is where both gravitational and quantum effects will be will be important, but it's very far from us in time. So it's difficult for us to probe that era to get experimental evidence of what quantum gravity should be like. So because of this situation where the evidence for different approaches to quantum gravity is scarce, there's a wide range of different approaches. So the community is a vibrant and large community. We're divided into different approaches. So some people will focus on one heuristic motivation, and some others will focus on a different starting point, if you like. And at the moment, the experimental evidence is scarce, and so it's hard to be guided by actual observations at the moment.
Right. So we don't see this happening at the moment. Like, we can't look out into space and see this happening.
We can. So cosmology, which is the study of the universe at the very largest scales that we can observe, is a place where we can look for evidence for different approaches to quantum gravity. And I think it's probably the most promising area that we can look to for evidence of different approaches to quantum gravity. And I am actually hopeful that more and more cosmological data will in the not so distant future start to distinguish between different approaches, and we'll be able to be guided by that cosmological data in our research in quantum gravity.
So what are the different approaches going on at the moment?
I could divide them roughly into two. I mean, there's overlap between them, and there are scientists who work on more than one approach. But very roughly speaking, they can be divided into two rough camps. There's one approach which is, roughly speaking, it comes from a tradition of particle physics, the physicists who have been focused on trying to understand matter at the most fundamental level. So working on the Standard Model of particle physics. And that tradition in theoretical physics has given rise to the approach to quantum gravity called string theory. And in that approach, the fundamental particles are conjectured to be different modes of vibration of a fundamental substance, which is one-dimensional. So that's why it's called string theory. So a string is one-dimensional. So that's that tradition, that particle physics tradition, has given rise to an approach to quantum gravity called string theory. The other tradition, roughly speaking, is to take space-time, this fabric, this four-dimensional fabric of space-time, as the starting point. So to try to think about it as having a quantum mechanical nature. And so, again, roughly speaking, that's a tradition of physicists working on general relativity, on gravitational physics. And from that has arisen different approaches which are more focused on space-time than they are on matter. So that's a rough description of two different approaches to the problem.
Wow. So, I mean, I know nothing about space-time nor string theory. Are you able to just, you know, it might be a big ask to explain what string theory is, but can you?
Interestingly, string theory has grown, I think, hugely beyond its original. Well, let me say so. String theory originated from actually directly from particle physics as a in that people were trying to understand the Standard Model, and in particular, they were trying to understand the strong nuclear force which binds together the nucleons in the nucleus of atoms. And string theory arose from trying to understand that. It broke out of those constraints when it was realized that in the string theory contained within it gravity, and that was, it was not designed to do so. So it was a very dramatic development, that a theory that was developed to try to understand matter, to understand the particles, fundamental particles, actually contained within it gravity. You could see gravity in there. And that was, I think, very, very motivational for a lot of particle physicists to start thinking about string theory as something that could be the theory of quantum gravity that we know we need. Now string theory there are many physicists who work on string theory for many different reasons, and quantum gravity is just one of them. So string theory sort of, it's broken its boundaries again, and many physicists work on it because they find it very, very attractive, very beautiful. It has a lot to say about quantum field theory, which is the area of physics that particle physics is based on, and it's a theory which is really rich. From its roots, it's grown to be something in which people have found more and more interesting things to look at, and quantum gravity is just one of them.
And you mentioned four-dimensional space-time.
Yes.
Can you explain? I mean, getting my head around four dimensions and space-time is quite difficult.
Yes. Yes, it is. It's a new worldview, a new way of thinking about the universe. How can you get your head around three dimensions?
Yeah, three dimensions is something that we're all familiar with, right?
Yes, good. Exactly. So, and what does that mean exactly? Well, what it means is that you can think of a thing. Let me say, okay, what have I got in front of me? I've got my teacup, right? So my teacup, I can think of that thing. And to say where it is, I have to give you three numbers, three coordinates. I can tell you how high it is above the floor, how far it is from the front wall, and how far it is from the side wall. So I can tell you, I can pinpoint its position in three-dimensional space by giving, I can pinpoint its position in space by giving you three numbers. And that's what mm-hmm. we mean by space being three-dimensional. So, for example, a map of Bristol, think of a map of Bristol, and you want to pinpoint your position in Bristol right now on that map, you only need to give two numbers, which is the two coordinates of the coordinate grid on the map. Mm-hmm. So the map of Bristol is two-dimensional. The space in this room is three-dimensional. I need three numbers to pin down where something is. And the idea of four-dimensional space-time is that you need four numbers to pin down not just where you are, but when you are. And what I mean by when you are is not you, because you persist for many moments of time, but a particular instance of you. So I mean you now. So to say where that event is of you and now, you need to say, give four numbers, three where you are in space, roughly speaking, and one when that moment is, what time it is at that moment. So four-dimensional space-time is the collection of all these events. Everything that happens needs four numbers to pinpoint it. Roughly speaking, three of space, where it is, and one of time, when it is. And if you collect together all of these events, they form this four-dimensional fabric of space-time.
But how does that relate to quantum gravity?
The Well, first of all, it relates to gravity. So it relates to quantum gravity because it relates to gravity. So if you take all of the events in the universe, then they form this four-dimensional fabric. And the four-dimensional and the structure of that four-dimensional fabric manifests itself as gravitational phenomena. So this four-dimensional fabric of space-time is gravity. It explains gravity. It tells us why the planets orbit the sun, and why the galaxies behave as they do, why black holes exist. So that this four-dimensional fabric of space-time is gravity. So to understand quantum gravity, we have to understand quantum space-time. So that space-time has to do with quantum gravity because it is the fundamental way that we understand gravity.
And so why is it important that we solve this problem of quantum gravity?
It's the epitome of what science is, to try to better our understanding of the universe. And as I said, the science tolerates contradictions, but it doesn't tolerate them forever. So science advances by resolving contradictions between different parts of our current understanding. So the drive, scientific drive to understand better, is what motivates our attempts to find, our quest to find a theory of quantum gravity. Because quantum gravity, the problem of quantum gravity is so fundamental, space-time is the arena in which everything that happens. It is our universe. And so understanding that better at a fundamental level is bound to have consequences which we can't foresee because we don't know what quantum gravity is yet. It's bound to have consequences in every part of our lives. Although, as I said, it's hard to predict what those will be.
Mm. And I mean, from your opinion, how far away are we from understanding that?
That would be... If I knew that, then, yeah, I just don't know. I think, as I said, a lot depends on what happens in cosmology in the future, what sort of new data will come in. At the moment, so for example, at the moment there's a tension. Some people would even say, now call it a contradiction, between our best theory of cosmology. It's also called confusingly called the standard model. But this is a standard model of cosmology. Between that best standard model of cosmology and our observations, in particular, our observations of the expansion rate of the universe. So the universe is expanding, our galaxies are getting further and further away from each other, and we can measure the rate at which that is happening. And that rate is now in contradiction, that measurement of that rate is in contradiction now with, or let me say, contradictions are strong. Experimental physicists are very conservative. They don't want to announce a contradiction until they're really, really sure. But there's now a growing tension between our observations of the expansion rate and today, the expansion rate of the universe today, and our standard model of cosmology. I think that is going to show that our standard model of cosmology has to be reformed, and I think that that's going to be a clue to quantum gravity. But we'll see. That's something that may or may not happen in the next few years as more cosmological data is gathered.
So at the moment, we're noticing that the expansion of the universe is happening faster than our standard model, if I got that right.
It's slightly more subtle than that. So you're right. The expansion rate... What you're referring to is that roughly about 20 years ago now, it was realized that the expansion rate of the universe is greater than it would have been if the so-called cosmological constant was zero. So the standard model of cosmology has changed over history. And 20 years ago, the standard model assumed that this so-called cosmological constant was zero. And that was in was shown to be in contradiction with the data, with our measurements of the expansion rate today. To resolve that, the standard model was altered to include a cosmological constant. And that standard model then agreed with the agreed with the observations. Now, what's happening at the moment is that these are much more precise measurements of the expansion rate today that are being made, and it's that's bringing the standard model into contradiction with the data, because the data is getting better and better. We're able to measure the expansion rate today at a higher and higher accuracy.
Do you think that there's any, I mean, that's just shown I had a misconception, really, because I thought we were still back at, 20 years ago, I guess. Are there any misconceptions out there in the general public about, cosmology or quantum mechanics?
When I give public lectures, I am amazed at how well-informed people are. I often get questions from the audience when I give a public lecture that are far more astute and incisive than questions that I get asked by my colleagues. I think it's because people are really, they have a much broader perspective. They want to know, they're much more questioning. They want to know, in general, why one is interested in this. Why is one doing this? What are the broader issues here? And I enjoy that enormously. And people are very, they're very astute. They can spot an inconsistency in your argument. So when you're talking to your colleagues, often people are very focused on details. They're focused on, that may already be working in that area and are not asking you why you're doing something, but just about a particular detailed calculation. So yeah, so I really enjoy speaking to non-experts, because they, their questions are challenging, very challenging, and often very, very well informed. So particularly about cosmology, I think people are very well informed, and I haven't come across anyone who asked a question that I thought, well, they just haven't kept up with the with the current developments. Quantum mechanics is a different matter, but that's not the fault of people, of interested non-experts. The confusion and perhaps misconceptions about quantum mechanics that abound, and that they do abound, are because the community of physicists itself has not come to a consensus about quantum mechanics and how to understand it. That is a remarkable situation, given that quantum mechanics was created in 1925, and has been, in the words of Einstein, our most successful physical theory. But there's still no consensus on how to understand it, what it means, what does it mean, what picture of the world does it give us. So it's a different situation from general relativity. There is consensus in the scientific community about the picture of the world that general relativity gives us. There is no consensus on the picture of the world that quantum mechanics gives us. There are different points of view, and one point of view is that even asking that question is a waste of time and we shouldn't bother. But amongst those who think that it is a genuine and important physical question, and I include myself in that category, there are different opinions. So what interested non-experts, people who are just generally interested in science, are picking up is that there is disagreement, there's controversy, there are different points of view, and there are many different, I would have to say, contradictory statements made by physicists about the nature of quantum mechanics.
And because we think that scientists or science, there's no room for opinion in science. And I think that that's in itself quite confusing to come across, you know, conflicting opinions.
Yes. I'm surprised that anyone would think that there are no opinions in science. How can anyone get that impression? There's science, you know, there's science thrives on debate and discussion and disagreement. We have to, yeah. I mean, even an individual scientist, so many, you know, if you look at what they say, their work, I mean, that develops over time. You know, people can hold contradictory views at the same time, and people's later work or statements can be in, you know, can disagree with their earlier work and statements. So yeah, as a community, we're constantly debating and arguing with each other, and that's it. It's the way science works, and also it's the strength of science. So individuals can always be wrong. In fact, we're wrong a lot of the time, but the community as a whole advances because we can reach consensus. We have to persuade each other. We have to convince each other that the evidence for something is strong enough that we change our opinion. And that's the strength of it. So as a community, we can be right, even though as individuals, we're constantly wrong.
And what about your own journey through science? How did you get to where you are today?
When I was young, a young girl and young student, I was very interested in maths. I wasn't too interested in physics at school, and I went to university to study maths. And then in my third year at university, I learnt about general relativity, and I loved it. I've loved it ever since, and it's been the rock on which I've rested my intellectual journey ever since. I still love it. I had the opportunity to teach it to my undergraduate students, and it was a joy, a privilege, and yeah, it was my dream teaching experience. I love it. So yeah, so that's I came to physics late in life, I suppose, in the sense that it was only while I was an undergraduate student that I started to be interested in physics. And quantum gravity always seemed to me to be the most fundamental question that one could ask. So I loved general relativity, but I could see that it didn't accord with our understanding of matter. And so I wanted to know, and still want to know, how to make that work, how to reconcile the quantum nature of the world with our understanding of gravity.
And can you sort of explain what is general relativity and why did you love it so much?
General relativity is our best theory of gravity, and it's also a theory of space-time. It's quite mathematical in its technical aspects, but its conceptual features are that we have a new view of the world as being four-dimensional instead of three-dimensional. So we live in space-time. We don't live in space with time ticking away for us. in fact, our world is made up not of three-dimensional objects, but of events, things that happen. So it's a new perspective on reality. So instead of fundamental things being tables and chairs and galaxies and planets, fundamental things are events, things that happen in space and time. And space-time is made of those events. So the events are more fundamental as building blocks for the universe than three-dimensional objects. So this, what I loved about it was this change of perspective. And it's not just a change of perspective that you are allowed to make. Science dictates that you must make this change, must have this change of perspective, because general relativity is empirically, testably, experimentally verifiedly better than the theory of gravity that came before general relativity, which was Newton's theory of universal gravitation. So this general relativity is it's our best theory, empirically, provably, demonstrably, and quantitatively better than our previous understanding was. And so this change of perspective that our world, our universe, is made of events and not of three-dimensional things, it's demanded of us as scientists. You have to take this perspective because general relativity is better than our Newtonian understanding. So that I was just thrilled and challenged and excited by this new perspective. I just wanted to know more about it and to learn more. And now I want to push the boundaries of our understanding so that it incorporates quantum theory. And the approach that I work on to this problem is one in which space-time is fundamentally granular or bitty, pixelated, atomic, discrete. There are many words that have the same connotation here. So that space-time is not... In general relativity, space-time is smooth and continuous. It's a fabric. It's a smooth fabric. But in the approach to quantum gravity that I work on, the conjecture is that this smooth, continuous fabric is just an approximation to something which is fundamentally granular, fundamentally atomic. So the word atom means uncuttable. So it's something you can't divide up anymore. You get to a smallest piece that can't be made any smaller. So space-time, in the approach to quantum gravity that I work on, is conjectured to be atomic. It's conjectured to be made of fundamental events that are the smallest possible events, and you can't cut them up anymore.
Wow. It's really hard to get your head around, isn't it? I'd really like to just hear about your PhD and what it was like working with Professor Stephen Hawking.
Mm. Stephen was my PhD supervisor, and it was an amazing experience being his student. He was a very generous supervisor to me. He involved me in the work that he was doing very generously. He gave me a great problem to work on, very interesting, and he was very approachable. I was a shy person and not good at putting myself forward, but he was not standoffish at all. He always made time for me, even though I would often have to wait a long time before seeing him because he was so busy. He always made sure that he made it clear that science and his work and his research was a priority. So yeah, that was an important part of my PhD. Yeah, the things that he taught me, they're still part of the way that I think about physics. So his focus on space-time as being fundamental, he he championed a particular approach to quantum mechanics called the sum over histories approach or path integral approach, which I think is the most fruitful way to think about quantum mechanics. So that's still part of my research. It's part of what my research is based on. And the opportunities that I got from being his student also helped me enormously in my subsequent career.
Sorry, what was that approach? And can you just explain that really quickly for me?
Yes, of course. So part of my work on quantum gravity involves trying to understand quantum mechanics itself better. I said that there is no consensus in how to understand quantum theory. And again, within that, there are different approaches, different opinions. So one approach to the foundations of quantum theory, this is not specifically to do with gravity, but just quantum theory itself, quantum mechanics and quantum field theory, is one approach is called the sum over histories approach. And that's due, it's associated very closely with the particle physicist Richard Feynman. So it's often called Feynman's sum over histories, although it dates back previous, I mean, it's older than Feynman. So it was actually initiated by Paul Dirac in the 1930s. But it's closely associated with Feynman. And in this approach to quantum mechanics, the same sorts of concepts as arise or that general relativity is based on are fundamental in the path integral approach to quantum mechanics. And those concepts are the concept of event, something that happens in space and time, and the concept of history. So a history is a detailed way in which an event can happen. So, for example, an event could be it's raining between 1 and 2 p.m. in Bristol. That's an event. It either happens or it doesn't happen. And a history would be a very particularly detailed way in which it can be raining. So the exact number of raindrops, a particular pattern in which they fall, whether it's windy or not as well as raining, all these details would be a history. So in the sum over histories approach to quantum mechanics, you think about a quantum system in terms of those concepts, things that can happen, events, and then histories, which are very detailed ways in which that thing can happen, that event can happen. And Feynman's sum over histories is a way of making predictions about those events. So there are rules for how to calculate the probability of an event happening. And the Feynman sum over histories gives you a way of calculating those probabilities. And we, my colleagues and I, are trying to base an understanding of the physical world, of the quantum physical world, on this sum over histories. And it's a work in progress. It's not complete, but it's a direction in which we are trying to go in understanding the nature of the quantum world.
And I wonder, thank you for spending so much time with me, but I wonder just quickly, is there anything about your experience with Professor Hawking that has impacted the way you work with your own PhD students today?
There are so many things, that let me pick out a couple. I went with Stephen to a workshop at the University of California in Santa Barbara at the Institute for Theoretical Physics there. And it was an amazing experience. I was just a PhD student. I met so many people whose work I knew. And Stephen made me give a talk. I didn't want to. I was just scared out of my skin. It was terrifying. But he wouldn't. He simply made me do it. He said, "Well, you're going to do it anyway," and I did do it. And it was although it was really very difficult, I'm really glad that I did. And he was like that. He just expected, he treated his students as intellectual equals in the sense that he listened to what we had to say. And obviously he was just vastly more experienced. So he knew that we didn't know that much, but he did, you know, he treated us, he listened to us as he listened to his colleagues. But he also expected us to do these things, that to embed ourselves in the community. So I do try to encourage my students to take every opportunity to speak about their work, to get comfortable talking about their research, and to take absolutely take every opportunity to present their work when they can, and not, even if they're worried, afraid, or don't want to do it, I encourage them to do it. I'm probably not as dictatorial as that. I wouldn't absolutely insist if they were if they really didn't want to. So that's one thing that's influenced me as an advisor, and also the fact that he just expected us to be involved in whatever he was doing at the time. So for me anyway, he had a research program, and I was just expected to be part of it. And I think that's very, very encouraging for a young scientist to feel that they're part of something bigger, part of a program of research.
That was theoretical physicist Faye Dauker on the problem of quantum gravity. Do let us know what you think of this podcast with a rating or a review wherever you listen to your podcasts, and be sure to pick up a copy of the latest issue of BBC Science Focus magazine. Inside, we have even more mind-bending science and try to find out what our consciousness really is this month. As ever, there's loads more inside.
Now, we have a message from our sister magazine, BBC Sky at Night. Back Garden Astronomy Week is back from the 2nd to the 9th of March. If you've ever wanted to get into astronomy but not known where to start, then this is the perfect opportunity. Join BBC Sky at Night magazine as they tell you how to get outside and make the most of the night sky. This year's event is centred around the moon. To join Back Garden Astronomy Week, receive daily updates, and download your free 62-page beginner's guide to stargazing, sign up at www.skyatnightmagazine.com/backgarden. Or tune into their special series of daily episodes of their podcast, Radio Astronomy.
Thank you for listening to the Science Focus podcast from the BBC Science Focus magazine team. We're the UK's best-selling Science and Technology Monthly, available in print and in several digital formats throughout the world. Find out more at sciencefocus.com or look out for us in your app store.